Britain remains a military power out of all proportion to its economic standing. Its soldiers still fight in corners of the world far removed from this tiny island off the northwest coast of Europe. Hundreds have died in Afghanistan and Iraq in the last decade. I'm Joe Glenton. I was Lance Corporal Glenton of 13 Air Assault Regiment until I was jailed for refusing to fight in Afghanistan. And that's why it's important for me to find out why young men volunteer to risk their lives in conflicts which the majority of their fellow citizens regard as unjust and illegal. But the same question is important for every parent who has a son or daughter of recruitment age, and for every taxpayer who cares how the military spend their money, and for every citizen who cares about the political health their country. So join me for The Soldier Myth and The War on Terror, a four-part series that talks to frontline soldiers about recruitment, training, fighting, and coming home. War is hell, runs the old cliche. That's not how it appears in the military recruitment ads. In these glossy, high-budget productions, it looks like a cross between a paintballing weekend, a day at Alton Towers, and a Club 1830 holiday. But the reality is very different. To uncover that reality, I spoke to Glenn Humphreys, who served in Afghanistan with 13 Air Assault Regiment, Matt Horn, who served in Iraq with the Scots Guards, Craig Rutherford, who served in Iraq and Kuwait with the Royal Logistics Corps, Ben Griffin, who served in Iraq and Afghanistan with the Parachute Regiment and later the SAS, and Alex Rigler, a former officer cadet at Sheffield University. We also spoke to Lindsay German, convener of Stop the War, Professor David Webb, expert in peace and conflict studies, Dr. Neil Faulkner, a conflict archaeologist and military historian, David G, who has researched military recruiting, and Joan Humphreys, whose grandson was killed in Afghanistan. In an age of mass media and deeply unpopular wars, what methods are used to attract potential recruits?
They have so many different ways of doing this now, from online games to brochures to visits to schools, schools away days at barracks. They have the hard copy brochures, of course, brochures for parents. They're very sophisticated set of marketing techniques they have now.
But alongside the increased use of media, a proven method of recruiting is to gloss over the reality of war with promises of other activities.
I can just remember actually some of the advertisement, and the advertisement I think is different to what it is now, what it was then, because I don't think we were doing anything in other countries at that point, was offering other activities, adventure activities.
Yeah, it was like
sports. That was the main thing.
Yeah, snowboarding and rock climbing.
But then like doing adventure training, the things that you want to be able to do, you know, and enjoying. I think that actually, that was one of the reasons what pulled me in.
They definitely, it came across as a good thing to be doing. You did a lot of adventurous training, so, you know, we went canoeing and rock climbing and mountaineering and stuff like that. And you don't see, obviously, the nitty-gritty side of it when you're a 14-year-old kid. You just see it's being outside, it's fun, spending time out there.
These assurances don't always turn out to be true. Craig recalls what he was told at the recruiting office.
And basically, they start throwing loads of things at you, like saying, oh, you'll be able to go canoeing, everything, it's a blast, you'll go here, you'll do things, everything like that. But I think the whole time I was there, I went go-karting, and that was pretty much what we did.
What they told you didn't turn out to be that accurate.
I would say so, yeah. It was a lot more, they made it seem more so like everything was more like a big fun, like, oh, just get yourself, travel the world, like all that sort of thing.
And so they talked about the like the adventure training stuff, and they really they really put that side of it forward.
To get
you in, basically.
Technically, I would say so.
Recruiters also play on the recruit's specific motivations.
A lot of it was aid to other countries. Like, I can always remember a picture, actually. It was a female medic or doctor in somewhere in Africa. Patching up children, you know, that sort of thing. So I suppose that was what it was.
Basically, what I was told that I was that I would gain is things like a driving licence, obviously steady payroll, lots of benefits in terms of travel, discounts and stuff like that off various companies and what have you, and a lot of support.
I think that there's a human interaction going on there. You've got the recruiter and the young person who's being recruited, and I think in those interactions there's no set guideline for how they encourage or persuade that person to join. I think you've got the people who turn up or are recruited, you've got a broad range of people, from people like me who were sort of zealous recruits, you know, really wanted to be a soldier, were already sold on the idea and just signed up straight away, to people who are maybe economic recruits. So they're in, on the whole, in the north of England, Scotland, Wales, areas of high unemployment, limited opportunities, and these people are looking to the army for a career, for training, and for money, for pay. And you've got a broad range of people in between that, and some people will have a mixture of those components, and there'll be other components as well. And so the recruiter, a good recruiter, coming from the point of view of the army, will look at that recruit and go, right, how can I play on this person? Am I going to use the economic argument? Am I going to use the ideological argument? Am I going to use the patriotic argument of defending your country and all this? And I think each recruiter, and a good recruiter, would be able to play on those things and put the emphasis on what that recruit is looking for.
I think this is a very strong feature of what's happening with the army, is the sense that people are shown a view of the army which looks very attractive to people. You learn to ski, you travel to exotic parts of the world, you learn a trade, you do all sorts of things. And particularly for young men, and a few women, but mainly men, in poorer parts of the country, in places like the west of Scotland, in the northeast of England, very little chance of getting a job or a decent job of the sort that they want. It's very, very attractive.
Even in these times of austerity, the military has vast resources at public expense.
What kind of money does the military put into recruiting?
They spend about £700 million a year on recruiting and training to the end of phase one, which is basic training. We don't know the full cost of training at phase two as well, which is the trade training. But about £700 million a year, just recruiting and training, initial training.
So with a massive budget and access to poor and underachieving children, the military is given a unique opportunity to attract potential recruits. So are these practices ethical?
I think one way of looking at that is to think about what would it take for a young person to be able to make an informed choice about enlisting. It would have to be a free choice, so a choice where there are genuinely other options they could take and the army is not the only career option available to them, which is largely the case, but if you're from a poor background, that'd be more difficult. It would need to be a responsible choice, so one that's thought through in terms of the implications ethically for being involved in the armed forces, and it would have to be informed. In other words, it would have to be made in awareness of what the pros and cons really are in the short term and the long term. So I'd say the ethical shortcoming of military recruitment at the moment is that there isn't a serious effort made to make sure that those young people who are at a very impressionable age in their development are fully aware of both the pros and the cons of signing up.
For me, recruitment, I think we need to look on a broader scale. Obviously, people focus on what the recruiters do. And these guys go into schools or they go to country fairs and, you know, sell the army to young men. And on the whole, it is young men, you know, that I think only 10% of the those recruited are female. And but I think we need to look at what society does as a whole. You know, like the remembrance parades, the museums, the military displays, the way that history is taught in our schools, you know, that the British Army is a noble force and that they get involved in noble wars. So even though the recruitment is something to focus on by the recruiters, I think we need to look at what society does as a whole.
So why is it that Britain, alone in the EU, continues these practices?
Well, I think the reason they want to focus on recruiting young people in particular is that once most people who actually go into adulthood and reach the age of 22, 23, tend not to want to choose a military career. So once people have started a civilian career at some point, the idea of joining the military tends to fall off. So the hope is that within the Ministry of Defence, that if you recruit from 16 straight from school, then people won't be lost to civilian careers. So that's why there's a focus on young people. I think as well, young people's minds are much more impressionable than adults, as we all know, which is why there are laws of the age of responsibility, when we can drink a pint of beer, when we can enter into a contract and so on, usually being 18. There are reasons we have those laws in order to protect young people who are more impressionable, more vulnerable than adults would be. But I think there is, it's well known that the armed forces are better able to shape the minds of a 16 or 17 year old than they are a 22 or 23 year old.
So is this way of recruiting effective?
It would be more efficient to phase out recruitments of 16 and 17 year olds, because to recruit 16 year old costs the state, the taxpayer, effectively twice as much as it does to recruit an 18 year old. That 16 year old has been recruited. They have a legal right to leave now before their 18th birthday if they choose to exercise that, and they also can't be deployed to theatre of war. So the UK is effectively recruiting people who can leave if they want, who can't be deployed, and it costs twice as much to train.
By law, anyone under the age of 18 serving in the military is a child soldier. There seems to be a fear in the military that losing access to children will have an impact on its recruiting numbers. The Army Cadet Force, in which I also spent time, is just one of the tools the military uses to recruit. Army cadet detachments are often attached to schools, and it was at school that Alex Rigler first became involved. I asked Alex about what he did as an Army cadet.
I was doing shooting down the range from the age of 13. And you're just shooting at this yellow target, human target. Yeah. And then when you do section and platoon attacks, you'd have many targets in various positions. You run around, a group of 14-year-old kids running around with guns, yeah, shooting at the targets, yeah, and afterwards you'd have your lunch and a cup of tea. And it was done in a very casual manner.
Yeah.
You don't think much of it then, it was just a good bit of fun. But then when you actually, in hindsight, look back on it, you realise it's a very militarised 14-year-old. And I thought of it as an adventure as well. You know, it was an interesting career choice. You know, I thought I'd be doing interesting things compared to, you know, working in an office and doing a normal job. I thought it was going to be a lot of fun.
So from a young age, Alex and his schoolmates were actively learning infantry combat skills.
All the training in cadets was infantry training. So you didn't do any specialist training in signals or military intelligence or anything like that. It was basic green training. Going around doing section and platoon attacks and stuff like that. It was very basic compared to when I got off to the officer training corps.
So you were learning fundamental infantry skills?
That was all you really got taught, was that sort of side of things.
Fighting, killing, taking and holding ground.
Section, yeah, attacks, platoon, yeah, attacks.
But instead of having a real enemy, you had a cardboard cutout.
While there is a lot of coverage and public debate over the recruitment of non-commissioned soldiers, there is much less regarding the recruitment of the officers trained to lead them. Officers are often recruited, indoctrinated, and trained through universities. After his time in cadets, Alex joined the Army Bursary Scheme. He signed the contract when he was only 16. The military would pay for his education if he committed himself to weekly military training at university and agreed to join the military after his degree was complete.
The OTC started out quite nice. You know, he did a few training weekends, meet up Wednesday. It was a good social life. I mean, it was really good. You know, you met people from who had similar interests. You got to go and do these fun things. But then the pressure started mounting because I had this scholarship and bursary. I was told that, you know, it's the right thing for me to do was go and get a Territorial Army commission whilst still being a student. So that would be 3 weeks at Sandhurst and all the extra training beforehand. And I did all the extra training beforehand and I dropped out a couple of weeks before I was meant to go off to Sandhurst to do the TA commission.
However, the military became increasingly demanding and the training commitment started to affect his education. Concerned, he approached his commander.
His words were, at the end of the day, your commitment is to us, the army, and you know, you've got to maintain that commitment because you know, you're going to be going off to Sandhurst and be a regular army career. So in a sense, I had sort of three commitments. I had my commitment to the regular army, which was a long-term commitment after university. I had my commitment to the officer training corps and I had my commitment to my degree. And you can't manage all three of them.
He says he found raising the issue with his officer like talking to a brick wall. At this point, he began to realise he had made the wrong choice.
I'd signed my scholarship contract when I was 16. And yeah, I still wasn't able to drink or vote.
He sent a letter of resignation to Sandhurst, listing his concerns. There has never been an official response. He was to learn, as I did, that the military can't handle rejection.
They said, you know, we understand that you're doing this for political reasons.
What do you think they meant by that? Did they expand?
No, they didn't. I said, well, as soon as he mentioned that, I said, I made it quite clear, you know, my priority for leaving, my main reason for leaving has been because it's ruining my degree.
If nothing else, it appears that he had managed to spook them. They responded in age-old fashion by rushing to cover themselves.
After I left the adjutant's office and was on my way out of the barracks, a friend of mine who was a young officer told me that had heard about it because the adjutant had asked everyone to write a statement about me and why I was leaving and stuff like that. I didn't quite understand that. And, that was a very strange thing for them to do, to ask around other young officers about my reasons for leaving. I think it was just them trying to cover their backs because obviously someone at Sandhurst wasn't particularly happy that I'd written a letter and was dropping out of my bursary and scholarship.
Among the worn clichés about why young men become soldiers are those regarding service to Queen and country, defence of the realm, or patriotic duty. In order to place recruitment in its actual historical context, I travelled to Norfolk to meet Dr. Neil Faulkner, a historian, author, and modern conflict archaeologist. He suggested we conduct the interview in a historical site which he felt had particular relevance.
It feels as if we're a long way from any battlefields, and in a sense we are, but because we're in northwest Norfolk, but we're standing inside a mortuary in a wood in the middle of what was, during the First World War, a training aerodrome, where between 1914 and 1918 there was, in a sense, mass production of pilots to go and serve on the Western Front. And they were getting through so many planes and so many pilots that they needed to ramp up these training aerodromes and to force the training pace to such a degree they were losing at an aerodrome like this roughly one pilot a month in a fatal accident. So hidden in the woods here, in the middle of the aerodrome, is a mortuary building, hidden away so that the casualties aren't demoralising the airmen living on the site.
I asked him to explain the historical forces which had compelled men into the military.
I think there are really two forces that mesh together. I think one is there's economic pressure. I mean, I think most of the ordinary guys joining the army are under some kind of economic pressure. It's seen as a way out of poverty, out of a dead-end job, out of a dull job on relatively low wages. So generally speaking, the army has always recruited from people who are looking for a way out. So there's an economic compulsion.
I'd say about five people from his class joined up pretty much around the same time. And each of them, their whole idea was to get away from what was going on round about them.
Living in a rough area as well, over this like South Shields and things like that, it was a bit rough on there, so basically we had to get out and look for a better, like, make a start in life, basically.
Because it offers you security, a place to live, three meals a day.
There's not a lot of opportunity in general anyway. There's not a lot of jobs. And it became difficult to find some work or some sustainable work.
But for these soldiers, as well as me, there was something other than money which drove us to join. It seems to me that the economic argument alone cannot explain why people volunteer for the military.
But I think it doesn't really work unless you also sell people an ideal. And the ideal is adventure, it's foreign travel, it's the idea of service and duty, of doing something worthwhile, something that's socially approved of, and so on. And it's a combination of those two things, I think, that's bringing people into the armed forces.
So the concept of it was quite appealing to a young, kind of fit bloke.
Test myself, I suppose, test myself to see what I could do and what I could handle and what I couldn't handle.
I think I was, if you want, indoctrinated from a young age. You know, if I went to a country fair and saw some parachutists jumping out of a plane or saw some soldiers there showing off their weapons, you know, I was interested by that. I was also interested by military history as a young boy. And I really sort of took all this in, you know, remembrance parades, any parades, you know, visits to war museums, visits to see ships. All this really sort of built up in me a desire to be a soldier.
I think I had these naive views that I'd be fighting the good fight. Sort of like if I was going to join the British Army, I had a view that fighting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that they were for good reasons, fighting terrorists and stuff like that.
So I wouldn't actually say that I was recruited at all. By the time I walked into the recruiting office, I was ready to join.
In peace studies and similar disciplines, violence is divided into subtypes, with physical or direct violence being just one of them. Recruiting, Professor Webb argues, uses the other two types of violence. The cultural violence, which reinforces the idea that these wars are somehow noble, and the structural violence of the potential soldier's economic predicament.
I mean, there's a lot of cultural violence in there, suggesting that it doesn't matter that the training you get would be used in order to kill people or invade other countries or whatever. But there's also the structural violence, which says, okay, you need a job. We're not going to give you a sort of decent job or an ordinary job that you can do something constructive in. We're going to give you or offer you this job where you can serve our needs, what we want you to do. So I think it's a mixture of all of those things, really.
It takes a lot to convince a teenager that their job in life is to kill another human being. But that's what our armed forces have to do. We've seen how the military seek to attract young people. In the next episode of The Soldier Myth and the War on Terror, we'll be looking at how new recruits are trained and at the values that go along with a life in uniform.